We're glad you're here. The Gonzaga Socratic Club is intended to address philosophically questions about Christian worldview issues and to explore the truth of the Christian worldview in both critical and positive ways. So we'd like to welcome you here for a very special presentation. We're going to be talking about the new atheism, this movement that you might have heard a little bit about that's associated with a number of figures in science, in philosophy, in intellectual life, and the challenges that religion in general and Christianity in particular is not only false but pernicious, dangerous for American and other societies and cultures. That's our topic for today. Our speaker today will be Aaron Brown. Aaron is a graduate student in philosophy here at Gonzaga University, and actually he is also a graduate of Gonzaga's undergraduate program. He received a BS in computer science with honors and continued on in the philosophy program. He has interests in phenomenology and personality and identity, and in questions of skepticism, and he has a particular interest in the new atheism, this movement that we'll be talking about today. So if you would, welcome Aaron Brown then.
First of all, thank you so much all for attending. It's good to see so many people engaged in the philosophical project here at Gonzaga. While giving my presentation, I just wanted to pass around some books that I brought. A few different books that kind of might give you a sense of who the authors are who are engaging new atheism. Daniel Dennett is probably the most prominent philosopher in the new atheist movement. A couple of books of his, Darwin's Dangerous Idea and Breaking the Spell. I'm just going to go ahead and pass these around so you can all take a look at them. John Allen Palos is a mathematician working at Temple University who has engaged various mathematical proofs for God and offered some mathematical evidence against, in the case against God. This is new with your religion. This Little Tome by Sam Harris, End of Faith, is probably the one book which is credited with starting the New Atheist movement back in 2004. Its subtitle, which is impossible to read from there, is Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. It was largely written as a response to the attacks on September 11th, and it deals largely with the role of religion and terrorism in the world, but also the role of religion and reason, education, culture, issues like that. This is probably the most popular book in the movement, The God Delusion, by Richard Dawkins, which came out, I think it was originally published in 2006. And it's probably the most succinct expression of the New Atheist Project. It makes the case quite clearly and simply that the God hypothesis on which religion is based is not only wrong, but dangerous. This is the book as I mentioned by Daniel Dennett, Breaking the Spell, which is about religion as a natural phenomenon and it's one that has evolutionary underpinnings rather than in some sort of metaphysical givenness by God. And the last one is for those of you who want just kind of digest version. It's the Quotable Atheist, cool, slick little book with just a bunch of quotes. So maybe if you don't have the attention span of the other books. Exactly. So the new atheism, as I mentioned, it's a very, very new school of thought. It really only dates back to about 2004. In fact, it's only been referred to as the new atheism since kind of 2006, what it started to be called in the media. It's largely a form of skepticism driven by an empirical view that defines, that first of all, defines religion as anything based on the God hypothesis. So it defines religion as being anything based on the God hypothesis. And the God hypothesis is, roughly speaking, the view that there is an omnipotent creator or deity in the world who takes a personal interest in the world and is somewhat responsible for it. Near atheists claim that this would include all the Abrahamic religions. Many of them extended to Hinduism. Generally speaking, all the deistic religions that we think of when we use the broad categorized term religion. There are a few exceptions. New atheists don't attack Buddhism exactly because of its lack of a strong sense of deity. It's kind of the movement itself. You have to forgive me, I'm getting over a bit of a lung plague thing. So, religion, as defined by the God hypothesis, is, according to New Atheism, a claim about the state of the universe. It's saying that there is a God in the world which cares about it, is personally involved in the world, and in most of its forms, cares about what happens and intervenes in the world. As such, the God hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis. Any claim you can make about the state of the universe is a statement about that science can address, can gather evidence for or against. So, in order to prove or disprove religion, for new atheists, the argument on that count is very simple. If you want to show that a certain religion is true, you gather evidence for its tenets. If you want to disprove it, you gather evidence against it. It's like any other scientific claim. Religious assertions are just like assertions in physics, biology, chemistry, and the assertions of Christianity are no different than the assertions of Keplerian motion or general gravitation. So, unless you can find evidence of the miracles claimed in the Bible, or you can find evidence for the historicity and divinity of Jesus, then Christianity falls apart the same way any of a number of scientific falsities have in the past. What really just separates New Atheism from other forms of skepticism of the past, especially century or two centuries, is that it's not just atheistic, but antitheistic. So it goes beyond simply the claim that these religious claims are false, or that there's no evidence for them. It goes so far as to say that because of things such as religious-sponsored terrorism, I'm sorry, I'm being distracted by some rabble-rousers here in the crowd. I can wait if you too. Sorry. Anyway, so not only is religion, according to New Atheism, false but harmful, some of the major issues with religion that are pointed to support this case of a pernicious view of religion are terrorism. The argument is made most often against the Islamic faith that a lot of the terrorist acts carried out in the world today would not occur if the perpetrators didn't believe in some sort of reward for what they were doing. Right? A simple, not kind of naive atheistic view of the world, and I use naive as a value-neutral term, meaning simple or basic. In a simple humanist view of the world, it makes no sense to try and strap a bomb to yourself and blow yourself up to try and accomplish a goal, largely because unless that one simple act will accomplish a great deal for your children or your children's children, you're not going to be around to actually reap the benefits of what you're doing. Similarly, a great deal of the impetus for these people to commit suicide bombings, for example, is simply that they believe there will be a reward for them afterwards. Sam Harris especially has some really gut-wrenching descriptions of the thought process of some of these suicide bombers that they've laid down in journals, people who have been thwarted in their attempts, things like that. And the care and the craftsmanship they go to in planning and executing these acts to please their deity, to please Allah, and try and kind of fulfill their beliefs, the wishes they impute to this as Richard Dawkins amusingly often calls it, sky friend, or sky fairy, or sky father, or there's all these kind of pejorative terms for a monotheistic deity that new atheists tend to use. Sam Harris, for example, discusses the really horrific case of one woman who, in preparing to go and bomb a bus full of Israeli settlers,
fills her the pockets of a trench coat with nails and rat poison, so that she's sure that even if she wounds someone, there's a good chance they'll die later. And then straps Simtex to her body. She was eventually stopped by the Israeli Defense Forces. But these are the kinds of things that they do, not because they think it will accomplish, strictly speaking, some political goal, but because it will please their deity or because of the religious effects of it.
You know, there's no questions in the PowerPoint.
Another kind of broad category of religious harms that are often identified by new atheists are intellectual harms. They say that, for example, it stifles curiosity. If you're raised to think that God did it is a valid explanation for some phenomena in the world, then you're likely to, if you don't understand some problem, if you encounter some block in science, say, oh, God did it. They point to examples in the past where God did it has been a sufficient cause for many years, and when it was later shown by science that God was not quite just the answer, that God kind of got pushed back into a kind of God of the gaps theology where whatever we don't understand is what, you know, God did, and everything we do understand, well, that's just science. Examples include the motion of the heavenly bodies. There used to be a view that the motion of heavenly bodies was somehow divinely controlled or divinely inspired. And it wasn't until Kepler came along and Newton and Galileo and the early physicists came along and showed us that there's real, normal, natural explanations for why these things move in spherical or oval-shaped orbits, that it wasn't simply God's divine hand. Well, before, God did it. Now, it's the matter of science. So, in looking at the creation of the universe, or the creation of being, a lot of new atheists say, why ought we to say God did it? We've said that before, and it's shown not to be the case. Why not just admit ignorance? They say that by teaching our kids that God did it is an acceptable, by being raised to think that God did it is an acceptable response to ignorance, what we're actually doing is stifling our urge to actually find out about the universe and explore our cosmos. Similarly, it's argued that religion divorces people from the fundamentals of reality. And this is actually gets to the heart of one of the kind of distinctions that new atheists make. The distinctions for new atheists is not simply between skepticism and belief, but between reality and fantasy. A lot of people coming to the New Atheist Project who are used to classical, kind of more civilized religious debate don't quite understand some of the disdain that some of the New Atheist thinkers have for religion. The God of the Bible, the God of Islam, the God of Judaism, these are all lumped in with the Tooth Fairy, unicorns, the Flying Spaghetti Monster, any kind of mythical creature you can come up with. It's often asked in seriousness. And I think it's a question that needs to be addressed, from a variety of angles, but new atheists often ask, what is the difference? What's the fundamental difference between the God of the Bible and the Easter Bunny? What are the critical differences that make belief in one as an adult acceptable and belief in the other naive or fanciful? And it's exactly this kind of identification that allows them to say, well, if you believe in God, then there must be some sort of divorce between the believer and reality. That there is some sort of gap there which allows them to impugn or to see in the world these mythical creatures. The same way they would say that if someone saw elves at the bottom of their, dancing in their lawn, you would say that person was divorced from reality. New atheists make the same claim about people who believe in deities. These beliefs about religious indoctrination also leading to cliquishness, violence, mistrust, and oppression lead to some pretty interesting claims by some of the new atheist thinkers. Some of the most famous ones are Richard Dawkins' claim that religious indoctrination, religious upbringing, properly viewed, is a form of child abuse. It's no different than teaching your kids
sorry.
It's no different than teaching your children that the earth is flat, or that there are monsters in their closet, or that if they... These are all claims that our parents, in a sense, willfully teaching their children things that are not true about the world. And Dawkins equates this with a sort of intellectual child abuse. Another claim he made the rounds when Sam Harris first made it in 2004 is that there are certain ideas so dangerous that people who refuse to disabuse themselves of those notions should be considered enemies of society and should be imprisoned or put to death. In this, in particular, he was talking about the ideas held by a lot of religious radicals about punishments for apostasy and things like that. The irony apparently escaped him that advocating death for a belief in the death penalty for apostasy is a bit twisted, but... and for as much as New Atheists point to radical stances in religion for their arguments as to its wickedness, they're just as hard on moderates, because they claim that religious moderates, for example, moderate imams, take, for example, a moderate imam who, while not endorsing suicide bombing or religious terrorism or the death penalty for apostasy, provide the philosophical framework necessary for these fundamentalists to continue in the world. He makes the argument that without a moderate religious base, there could be no large-scale fundamentalist campaigns of the kind we see with terrorist bombings in the Middle East, or of any sort of religious-sponsored terrorism. So, in short, the short version is the religion is unfalsifiable, that is unscientific mysticism and mythology, and far from being beneficial or even harmless, is a blight on modern society. So not only is it wrong, not only is it a claim about the universe, which is either unscientific or is scientifically unsupportable, but the existence of this belief, the fact that it's held by so many people throughout the world, causes very real suffering and very real harm in modern society. So that's kind of the overview of New Atheism. You want me to brief overview of some of the New Atheist thinkers are. And again, this is a very, very new school of thought. It's only been around since about 2004. So one of the big names in New Atheism is Richard Dawkins. He's an ethologist and evolutionary biologist from England and currently holds the Charles Simonian Chair for the Public Understanding of Sciences at Oxford University. He made his scientific breakthroughs, or kind of break onto the public scene, in the 1970s when he came up with the idea of memes, or intellectual replicators analogous to genes. His one big contribution to the field to New Atheism is the God Delusion, which some of you have seen it passed around, which is a very, very empirically driven, very scientific look at the question of religion, showing not only that it's unsupportable, but that it's damaging. Sam Harris, probably the first, is the author that most people say is kind of was the start of New Atheism with his book End of Faith. And he later followed up with Letter to a Christian Nation, which is designed to address the criticisms that End of Faith drew. Again, came out in 2004. It remains actually probably the most editorialized and most kind of hyperbolic of the volumes. He makes a lot of really, really impressively over-the-top claims. If you do want a sense of how far New Atheism goes in its critique of religion, End of Faith and The God Delusion are part of the two books to read. I mean, these are I have a hard time sometimes getting across the point that these are people who think that the very belief in religion is harmful. That the very fact that people in this room, for example, believe in the Christian God or any other kind of religion does real harm in the world.
Christopher Hitchens, another British thinker, he's a journalist for Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, The Nation, Slate, and others. The author of God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, and a newer book, The Portable Atheist.
Again, very similar in views to Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins. These are all kind of straight New Atheism. And the great thing about God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, is everything you know about the book is right in the title. It really is about how religion, anything you can think of, is made worse by religion, essentially. The last kind of major figure we'll talk about is Daniel Dennett, who is a philosopher and actually probably the most moderate voice of the major New Atheist writers. Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, is a fairly even-handed treatise talking about the potential natural sources or evolutionary sources for religion. What benefits religion would have given us as an evolving species. Historically, what benefits a religious culture might have had over a non-religious one. Why it is that if, as New Atheists say, religion is so damaging and dangerous, why has it become so prevalent? Why is religion the rule rather than the exception? It's a fascinating read. And like I said, it is a fairly even-handed assessment of the cases for a natural source of religion. Kind of tangentially, I'll mention his other book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, which deals with the question of evolution and meaning in life. I say tangential because it's not strictly speaking on religion, but it's also a very good read and also makes a very good companion book to the evolutionary arguments he makes in Breaking the Spell.
So. Other important figures in the movement, both for their writings and for what they represent. Ayaan Hirsi Ali is a critic of Islam, an Islamic apostate, and the author of Infidel, which is an autobiographical work. She's been threatened. One of her political allies in Denmark was assassinated. She attained amnesty from the U.S. and moved here with security provided by several European nations. They've recently removed the security they placed on her, and there's been several movements amongst the New Atheists, several kind of fund drives almost amongst the New Atheist movement to try and get funds to get her protection. She's a very high, kind of high-profile target for several fatwas, and it pretty much all stems to what she has said about Islam, the fact that she has said that Western free nations cannot coexist with modern Islam. Her book, Infidel, paints a really unflattering picture of the life of women and apostates under Islam. And some of the things she said about the Islamic faith, as well as her status as an apostate, have caused a wide range of Muslim political religious figures to declare her an enemy of the faith. And she's been, very high-profile target. John Allen Palos, is one of his books I passed around, is a noted atheist and mathematician at Temple University. His new book, Irreligion, I just actually finished a couple weeks ago. It's really, really interesting. It's very readable, kind of a digest of various classic arguments for religion, and why, from a mathematician standpoint, they just kind of don't add up, as the subtitle so wittily and pontastically tells us. It addresses everything from very, very old classic arguments like the first mover argument, the ontological argument, all the way up through kind of newer, hipper ones like the argument from the anthropic principle and things like that. It kind of takes a random scattering of 10 of the most classic arguments for God and takes a very, very strictly mathematical, analytical look at them. Really good read. I highly recommend it to anyone. P.C. Myers is a biologist and author of the Pharyngula blog, he's one of the most outspoken American scientists in favor of New Atheism. New Atheism has garnered huge support amongst the scientific community, largely because of its empirical stance towards religion.
The fact that its major proponents are an evolutionary biologist, a philosopher of science, that they have all this very tight ties to the scientific community, as well as its empirical stance, makes it very attractive to the scientific community. And a lot of its most high-profile adherents are scientists. Rebecca Watson is a radio presenter of Skeptics Guide to the Universe and founder of skeptic.org. Interesting, if any of you are interested in kind of a feminine perspective on it or the feminist aspect of New Atheism, she's probably the most outspoken female proponent of New Atheism or kind of New Atheistic ideas. Marcus Brigstocke's a comedian from England. Attained some amount of internet notoriety about a year ago, and a couple of his bits about atheism and kind of bashing the three Abrahamic religions got popular online. Phil Platt, an astronomer, again, scientist, so many others. A lot of these figures, again, are scientists, religious apostates, or both. So, I'm not sure how much time we got left for that, but I've got a few address underlying themes. As I said earlier, for New Atheism, it's not simply about belief versus skepticism. It's about, so you can cast the question in terms of rationality versus faith, but more often New Atheists are likely to talk about it in terms of naturalism versus supernaturalism. That is, the belief that there's the natural world, and that's it, or the belief there's some, in some sense, something outside the natural world which we can't understand. For New Atheism, supernaturalism is really just tantamount to incoherency. If you can't talk about something, if it's so outside the natural world that we can't describe it scientifically, why attempt to talk about it at all? How do we know that anything we say about it is true, false? How do we know if it's right, wrong? In sense, it doesn't make any sense. It's absolutely, totally incoherent, and therefore ought to be discarded because it's not even a valid thesis. Again, another favorite way that they cast the question is in reality versus fantasy. There's two ways to look at the world, and that is the right way and the wrong way, essentially. There's the look of the naturalistic stance where you're saying, what can we say about the world? What can science tell us about the world? What do our senses and our evidence tell us? It's a very evidence-driven, naturalistic look at the world. And the other one is, quite frankly, just superstition. What did a bunch of Bronze Age tribesmen thousands of years ago write down in a book and pass down to their children? Those are the two. I mean, those are the two sides of the question as far as New Atheism is concerned. And cast that way, for New Atheism, the answer looks simple: that science is the only answer. That it doesn't even make sense to try to use religion to understand the world. Finally, this new atheistic worldview lumps religion into the same kinds of the same ontological category, the same category of belief as astrology, conspiracy theories, mythology, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, Bertrand Russell's teacup, all of it. So, in conclusion, new atheism sees religion as an outmoded collection of Bronze Age superstitions. They're doing real tangible damage on the individuals, but society as a whole. It's the cause of terrorism, wars, the spread of disease, a blinkered view of reality. You name it, and New Atheism can find a way to blame it on religion. New Atheism is very, very attractive to a lot of people in the United States who see the rise of a very conservative, fundamentalist Christian element on the political right. I know, as an atheist, looking at New Atheism, some of the things that I find very attractive about it are that it, in modern American culture, there's a very, very profound vanguard of fundamentalist Christianity that a lot of American skeptics find very worrying. And to find people speaking so fiercely in favor of a skeptical attitude towards the world can be reassuring. Very much kind of a preaching to the choir kind of thing. We all like hearing people shout loudly when they're shouting stuff that we agree with, you know. And really, that is one of the major differences, is that New Atheism comes out of America and Britain, which are two cultures which, for the past kind of 100 years or so, have not been in the forefront of skepticism, and when they have not been so loudly or vocally, publicly. The secularization of Europe happened primarily first on the continent, and kind of happened by tacit in the UK. The Church of England is still the official church of the British Crown. There's still a state church in England. In America, there's still a very, very large minority of Americans who want to understand America as a fundamentally Christian nation, and to have that written into the very fundament of what it means to be not only America, but American. There's a famous quote that a lot of atheists like to banter around to kind of show the danger of the opposing view, by George Bush, the elder, who said, "I don't know that atheists should be considered patriots. I don't know that that atheists should be considered Americans." So, New Atheism, for people who are already of a skeptical mindset, can be kind of refreshing, simply because of its fervor, if nothing else. And I think there's a lot of skeptics out there who are bolstered by it, not because they agree on every point, but because they agree on enough points and it's being said with enough confidence that it's kind of a comfortable change. I'd like to close out with kind of two quotes, which to me sum up the two prongs of New Atheism. The first is by the mathematician Pierre Simon Laplace, who, when confronted by Napoleon about a book he had recently written, Napoleon asked him, "Where's God? How could you write such a supposedly profound book without any reference to God?" And Laplace answered him, "God? I have no need of that hypothesis." That to me strikes the first part of New Atheism, that God, like anything else, is a hypothesis, and if you can't support it, if it's not needed, why bother talking about it? And the other is by the ever fantastically clever Voltaire, who said that the first priest was the first rogue who met the first fool. And to me, that hits right at the heart of religion is something which does far more harm than good. So, anyway, I hope this has been at least an enlightening presentation. Happy to entertain any questions, points of clarity if you have any. If not, I'll yield the floor to Mr. Brent Dybul.
Okay, let's thank our speaker. We'll let you come back in just a second. Okay. In keeping with the mission and structure of the Socratic Club, our approach is, you may have seen the slogan on our website, is to follow the argument wherever it leads, and that's what we hope and intend to do. And one of the ways that we build this into the structure of the Socratic Club is that we have a respondent at each of our meetings, not so you can just see performed an argument, although there's something to that, to help spur the conversation and get us going. But we'll also have time for questions and discussion in a moment. I can't resist noting one thing that Aaron didn't mention about Voltaire. You all know that Voltaire was trained by the Jesuits, don't you? That's an important little detail that we always want to throw out when we talk about Voltaire. Yes. One of our own. I don't know if we should put it quite that way. We will have a response today from Brent Dybul, who is also a graduate student in the philosophy department here at Gonzaga University. He has interests in philosophy of mind, classical philosophy, and philosophy of religion. He was a graduate of Seattle Pacific University, and he came here in 2002. So, welcome, Brent.
I'd like to thank Aaron for giving a rousing presentation, and Dr. Calhoun for asking me to respond. And I'll try to keep these brief because I'm pretty sure people want to say something about this. In the 1947 film Miracle on 34th Street, an endearing old man fortuitously wanders into the midst of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day preparations. After finding the hired Santa Claus drunk, Doris Walker asks the kind old man, who looks strikingly like Santa Claus, if he will work the float instead. Because of his popularity, he's later employed at Macy's as the store Santa. After meeting Doris's daughter, Susie, he finds that Susie's world has been demythologized by her mother to the point that she no longer believes even in using her own imagination. He takes it upon himself to prove to her that there really is something worth believing in, and that he, in fact, is really Santa Claus, and not merely a nice old man with real whiskers. A seminal moment in the movie occurs when Doris realizes that it is important for her daughter to believe in Santa, in the sense that the idea of Santa stands for something needed by humanity. Echoing the definition given to her earlier by the lawyer representing Santa in court, Doris exclaims, "Susie, faith is believing in something when common sense tells you not to." Susie then repeats the phrase, "I believe, it's silly, but I believe," clearly unconvinced until the end of the film, which leaves the question open as to whether Kris Kringle really was Santa Claus. Now, it would be a mistake to argue that new atheists like Richard Dawkins are rehashing 1940s Hollywood pop theology, but there is a striking resemblance to the way the new atheists defined faith, especially in regards to its relationship with reason. And I'll speak mostly of Dawkins because that's whom I'm most familiar with. Aaron, you can address the others as you see fit. Dawkins, speaking about the dangers of radical Islam's tendency to shun serious theological reflection, writes, and I quote this, "More generally, and this applies to Christianity no less than to Islam, what is really pernicious is the practice of teaching children that faith itself is a virtue. Faith is an evil precisely because it requires no justification and brooks no argument. Teaching children that unquestioned faith is a virtue primes them, given certain other ingredients that are not hard to come by, to grow up into potentially lethal weapons for future jihads or crusades." And that's in The God Delusion. The idea of faith endorsed here seems to be belief in something in spite of, or perhaps even because of, lack of evidence. And this is as good a place as any to start. In The God Delusion, Dawkins gives the God hypothesis and what I call the God alternative. The God hypothesis states that, and I quote, "There exists a superhuman, supernatural intelligence who deliberately designed and created the universe and everything in it." The God alternative is that, and I quote once again, "Any creative intelligence of sufficient complexity to design anything comes into existence only as the end product of an extended process of gradual evolution." So far, so good. So the first question that needs asking is whether or not Dawkins, or the new atheists in general, has the notion of faith correct, such that one could only hold the God hypothesis blindly, and that there is no reason available that could justify such a belief, except for perhaps that it gives comfort in one's trials and tribulations in life. That is, the denial that faith itself can be a rational act. Given the number of debates he has with the theology, philosophy, and math scholars, there are a number of theists who deny this definition outright. Since we're at a Catholic university, I thought it might be helpful to give a brief description of Thomas Aquinas' view of the relationship of faith and reason to see if we can make some headway in this discussion. In the Summa Contra Gentiles, Thomas argues that there are two ways one can come to know truths about God. He grants that there are certain truths that are certainly beyond our ability, since we are limited creatures with limited intellects, intellects that are dependent on the senses for their starting point. Thus, one would expect that if there was a personal God that took an interest in one's life, and God being far greater than the intellect that can conceive of him, God may need to disclose this to us, since reason alone could not discover it. This would include things such as the Trinity, etc. Alternatively, there are some truths about God that are open to reasonable investigation. Thomas puts it in this group, beliefs such that he exists, and certain attributes that a first principle must have. Now, already there seems to be a problem. It seems that the new atheists will deny the first claim outright. Why should we expect any disclosure? And the second claim on the basis that there is no possible evidence that could justify it. What is interesting is that the God hypothesis, as quoted in Aaron's presentation, or that which I quoted from The God Delusion, seems to be a combination of these two modes. Bracketing Alvin Plantinga's notion that belief in God may be properly basic, this claim seems to be the one attacked, at least by Dawkins. Aaron may be able to speak as to whether or not the others do the same. There are two ways Dawkins attacks it, both essentially related. In The Blind Watchmaker, Dawkins lists rival theories to Darwinism that try to show how evolution happened without accepting Darwinism, or, as he says, that are just plainly against the very spirit of Darwinism. These include Lamarckism, neutralism, mutationism, and creationism. With regard to creationism, he states that the enlightened creationist either gives God a supervisory role in evolution or has him, quote-unquote, meddle in the day-to-day events. He writes, and I quote, "If we want to postulate a deity capable of engineering all the organized complexity in the world, either instantaneously or by guiding evolution. That deity must already have been vastly complex in the first place. The creationist, whether a naive Bible thumper or educated bishop, simply postulates an already existing being of prodigious intelligence and complexity. If we are going to allow ourselves the luxury of postulating organized complexity without offering an explanation, we might as well make a job of it and simply postulate the existence of life as we know it. Exclamation point. That is, there is no causal role for God because he would need a cause as well. I actually heard him make this argument against Dr. Lennox on the radio debate late last year. The second related argument is his rebuttal of Aquinas' famous proof for God's existence in the God delusion. I won't write them all down, but the first three are related. For example, the uncaused cause argument goes something like this, and this is how he roughly puts it in the God delusion. Nothing is caused by itself. Every effect has a prior cause, and we are pushed into a regress. This has to be terminated by a first cause. We call this God. As he writes in response to this argument, it would be more parsimonious to conjure up a Big Bang singularity or some other physical concept as yet unknown. And he quotes, "Calling it God is at best unhelpful and at worst perniciously misleading. After all," he gives the example of cutting gold into smaller and smaller pieces. "One would expect a natural terminus to this activity. Once again, even though it is an argument for an uncaused cause, God still seems robbed of his explanatory role." The reason I say both of these examples are essentially related is that there's an attempt to argue against any causal, or perhaps more aptly put, explanatory role God may have in the world. Both examples presuppose a certain kind of causal agency that the theist must assert God exercises in the world. God either tinkering in creation for either an evolutionary effect, or just playing God of the gaps reason, as Aaron put it. Or him being the unflicked flicker, the cue ball that starts the universe ticking, which consequently seems to be Dawkins' understanding of the first mover proof, given the Big Bang comment. Now, oddly, most defenders of uncaused cause arguments in its articulation in either Aquinas or Aristotle see it as an infinite regress of explanations, not of pushes and pulls. As Stephen Barr relates, Thomas's argument doesn't rely on temporal sets of antecedents and consequence. In fact, there was nothing he saw logically contradictory about an infinite regress of the temporal chain of causes like fathers begetting sons. In fact, Thomas was thinking more of the simultaneous acting causes of the type Searle talks about, where water molecules vibrating in lattice structure cause solidity. It's not as if the lattice structure happens before the solidity, but nevertheless, it explains it. The infinite regress is one of explanation, where if we can't terminate the series of explanations, the system itself cannot be explained. It's the cosmological equivalent of Ned Block's causal drainage argument. And it's really an attempt to answer the more basic questions of why does the universe have the nature that it does? Why is there a universe? Or why is there something rather than nothing? The overall point here is that Dawkins doesn't seem to engage this understanding of the argument at all. This conception, while perhaps contentious, I mean we can disagree about it, is widely held by scholars in both the Aristotelian and Thomistic traditions, and seems to make the notion that God would need an explanation somewhat nonsensical. Explanation itself requires God, in the deepest sense. My concern here is that it doesn't seem like Dawkins is either aware of this way of understanding the argument, or has chosen not to engage it. Either way, it would require an argument of another fashion to dismantle it, since, by the Thomist light, even Dawkins' position requires it to be intelligible. To ask these kinds of questions is, by Richard Swinburne's understanding, actually demanded by what rationality is, and hence a highly rational endeavor. So my question for the new atheist is twofold. Is defining faith as irrational really an argument that it is so? And do people here think that, on balance, they take the strongest and hence most charitable reading of the theist's argument and attack that rather than merely ridicule it? So, Aaron, if you'd like to
come respond, and then we'll have some open question time.
Sorry,
okay, you can respond if you want.
Well, thank you very much for your comments. I regret that I was a lot less organized than ran my initial presentation. I think one particularly kind of awkward sticking point in discussion about between new atheism and theology, particularly, is just how different the basic territories are. For New Atheism, again, because of its empirical worldview, largely the only arguments they're going to hold any traction are going to be arguments rooted in the world, scientific arguments, arguments to human effects and causes, things like that. So theological arguments, I mean, your comments from Aquinas were spot on and very much the issue. The problem is that a great deal of new atheists will just reject them out of hand. Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, all these people, in fact, lump theology in with fairyology or ufology and say, really, unless you're offering me hard empirical proofs for God, what are you offering me? So they will make lip service to responding to, again, John Allen Palos' book, Irreligion's all about that, offering responses to proofs for God. But most of the new atheist thinkers will say, unless it's an empirical proof for God, unless you're pointing me to some sort of hard physical evidence and saying this is God, this shows that God exists, it's not actually an argument. So on the one hand, there's the fact that new atheism largely rejects theological frameworks for discussion. On the other hand, Brent raised another excellent point, and that is that the question of what is faith is a bit contentious, as is the question of what is religion. I think, like I said, new atheism is kind of a twofold philosophical school. The first prong is religion is misguided or false in some sense, at least in the specific doctrine, if not in the whole project. And the second is that it's dangerous. Your definition of religion will affect how effective the first tract of new atheism is. Again, most new atheists use some sense of the God hypothesis definition of religion in defining or in attacking it. If you disagree largely with that definition, well, a lot of new atheist arguments as such start to sound a little off the point. Similarly, with definitions of faith that Brent brought up, it's exactly because new atheists define faith as belief absent of reason or evidence that a lot of their arguments about the dangers of religion make sense. I would like to make a brief case, if I could, for if not a theological case for theological or philosophical definition of faith that way, as for a practical one. New atheism is, in a lot of sense, a reactionary school. It's a reaction against the modern high-profile cases of religious terrorism in the world, as well as a rising tide of fundamentalism in America and, to a lesser extent, in the UK. A great deal of what this school is responding to, then, uses arguments that are precisely anti-evidentiary or anti-rational, right? Saying things like, we don't need to, you know, we don't want to teach evolution in our schools. We don't care if there's any evidence for it. The Bible says differently, and we believe the Bible. It's that kind of fundamentalism that new atheism is responding to. So the sort of faith that they're responding to, while theologically suspect, or while perhaps not properly considered faith in the sense that Aquinas meant it, is in very real and practical senses the kind of faith that people are dealing with in America these days, or that new atheists see as being behind a lot of the terrorist attacks the world over. Similarly, it's exactly the varieties of faith, the varieties of religion, that often cause and garner new atheist response. Richard Dawkins uses what I think is a fantastic example when he says that it makes no sense to talk about Christian children, Muslim children, Hindu children. You might as well talk about Marxist children, Keynesian children, and monetarist children. They're too young to know what their religious stance is, the same way they're too young to know what their economic stance is. It's exactly these differences and the cliquishness that it inspires that makes one's definition of faith almost beside the point, right? The only difference is that, at least at the moment, you don't have Marxists blowing up capitalists exactly because they're capitalists, right? But again, it's been that way in the past, I guess, so who knows? Could be again. Yeah. So I would argue that Well, I completely agree. Aquinas has some very interesting things to say about faith, about reason, about the relationship between the two of them. For New Atheism, they're often largely beside the point, both because what faith is in a theological sense and what it is in a practical sense can often be different in different cultures throughout the world, and because, quite frankly, faith itself is not always the problem. Religion is often the problem for New Atheists. So.
Okay, Brent, if you wouldn't mind, maybe if we can get some chairs here. If you guys want to sit down, we can both have you come up here. And we'd like to open some time for discussion now. So if you have questions, maybe you can address your question to both of our speakers or to one of them in particular if you'd like to. So just have a seat if you'd like to. So I'll let you guys take questions too.
Okay. Father Clancy.
One of the things that irritates me about the New Atheists is what I consider to be their disingenuousness. Do they really think Al-Qaeda and the Iraq War is a religious war? Do they really think that it's a religious issue that is driving them to blow people up?
Well, with the Iraq War, no. In fact, Sam Harris came out very much in favor of the Iraq War, which has garnered, which puts him in a very
the odd place. To the American liberation of Iraq.
Okay. A lot of them, no, will not cast that in strictly religious terms. They will cast Al-Qaeda in religious terms. They will cast Hamas in religious terms. A lot of the Islamic terrorism. And the cases they make for it not being, for example, an economic factor are that a lot of the suicide bombers come from affluent backgrounds. That it's not a strictly a social pressures background is evidenced by the fact that many of the Saudi bombers have spent time being educated in the West. So yes, a lot of them do honestly believe that suicide bombing, for example, is made possible only by certain metaphysical beliefs about the world. Certain beliefs about what happens when we die, what is the state of our being, do we have a soul, is there a God who cares?
So Japanese kamikaze pilots, many of whom are Buddhist,
right.
Pass.
And a lot of them will say that
they're going to reap any rewards, that they're just expressing the nothingness of reality.
That's a fantastic point, and actually, but I think a lot of the New Atheists would respond that it's if not the same frameworks, it's the same kind of thinking. It's an ascription to their belief in a higher power. In the case of many of the kamikaze pilots, divinity of the emperor, or the rightness, the divinity of the state. There's been some interesting New Atheist arguments trying to make sense of single-party states, which share a lot of commonalities regardless of their religious affiliation. Hitler's government, strong Christian overtones. Stalin's government, absent of them. Pol Pot's government, decidedly anti-intellectual. I mean, a lot of very different impetuses and official religious views. A lot of commonalities in what they wound up doing. So a lot of New Atheists make sense of that by arguing that the same kind of faith is required for a nationalistic devotion of the kind that Nazi Germany had, that people had for Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia, as is required for Islam.
So nationalism is
religion now? Is a sort of state religion, yeah.
And this is still an empirical term we're talking
about? A lot of them would argue yes, and again, it goes back to their definition of faith as belief without reason. They believe in the rightness or the perfection of their state, absent of any other kinds of arguments that are made against it. Yeah.
So it would seem to be a more reasonable thing for them to be arguing against theology, even against their own to a certain extent. Because Sam Harris is arguing that apostates, people who believe that apostates should be killed,
should be killed.
So the New Atheism is an ideology and a faith just as dangerous as anything they're criticizing, it would seem.
Again, it's I would say a little, to say that new atheism is a faith can be, I think, defensible or not, depending on whose definition of faith you talk about.
Using
their own, they have every reason. New atheism is not a faith simply because they're making no claims about the universe that they can't defend using empirical evidence. If someone says there's a God, they're saying, fine, prove it. They're kind of abiding by the rules of parsimony by not claiming external agents. They're not saying that, you know, that you shouldn't believe in God because the Easter Bunny tells you not to believe in God. They're not saying you shouldn't believe in God because Richard Dawkins tells you not to believe in God. All they're saying is the only way we have of understanding the world is based on the evidence, and the evidence doesn't support religion, so you shouldn't believe in it. Furthermore, here's all these religious people doing all these horrible things for society. There's some pretty good evidence that religion causes these people to do these things. Therefore, you should believe and you should act like religion is a dangerous thing.
However, they are drawing moral claims from this, and they're also not addressing a massive amount of evidence for theism to a certain extent. They're also not addressing the fact that Soviet Russia was an atheist state,
mm-hmm.
and slaughtered more people than the Russian Orthodox Tsarist state ever did.
Yes, but the point is not body count. The point is not atheists killed more people than Christians, therefore Christianity is right. In the same way the capitalist-communist divide isn't decided based on who killed more or fewer people.
No, but the question of dangerousness would seem to be, the body count seems to be relevant if you're going to make an argument about danger of religious faith versus an atheist acting upon an atheist ideological framework.
Mm-hmm. Again, and that's why a lot of new atheists are very careful to make claims about Hitler's religious stances, the religious overtones in a lot of single-party states, exactly because there's so many commonalities. There's so much brutality across the board between so many different kinds of ideologies. And in fact, I think a lot of people, there's a lot of traction to be gained actually by kind of disregarding single-party state cases, because it's so easy to say, you know, Hitler was a vegetarian, therefore vegetarianism causes mass genocide. Whereas, you know, Stalin ate heaps of red meat, so red meat probably causes the same thing.
Well, what if a single party, say, Quaker state, or a single party pacifist, you know, a religion that mandates absolute non-violence?
Just to kind of drive things forward, could you give me an example of...
It seems like we're dependent on ideology. It's not, you cannot merely say that ideology itself or faith itself...
Well, perhaps I was too hasty in equating single-party state with totalitarianism. But largely, I mean, totalitarian states of you know, like the Khmer Rouge, Nazism, Stalinism. So.
This guy back in the green here has been waiting for a while.
Sorry.
Remembering a question about, like, how's your options? As far as, like, you do stuff like close to your mind, maybe what was your standpoint in terms of the workings of, like, of their mind and how it might be very similar to somebody who's doing a suicide bombing for religious reasons or suicide bombing for totalitarian reasons for their Japanese deity? Who's the real person? As far as I can't remember. Sam Harris said a whole bunch of stuff about how religion is actually intertwined in these secular genocide.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember. Like, what do you think about that in terms of working with their mind?
You mean in terms of belief structure and worldviews? I mean,
for whatever reason that would happen within somebody's mind, that they could place the value of their life below something that really they'll never get hold of.
Well, I mean, I guess one question is, can we act for a value that won't be realized in our own lives? And I think there's pretty good evidence that we can. I mean, we can act self-sacrificially to our children, for example. Now, you might have a biological completely naturalistic reason for doing that, but nevertheless, you're not going to reap the benefits in any substantial way for yourself. So, I mean, I don't know. Is that what your question is getting at there? Aaron, do you want to talk about that?
I was going to say the new atheist viewpoint is very much that the patterns of belief are similar in that
it's some sort of deification in that you're doing an action to please a deity, and the act of pleasing that deity is more important than your own life, right? In the case, for example, of an Islamic suicide bomber, pleasing Allah is more important, not only because you'll get rewards in the afterlife, but because kind of a teleological suspension of the moral. What is good is what God wills. Laws don't matter if they're not God's law. Will doesn't matter if it's not God's will. And so if God wills you to strap a bomb to yourself and blow yourself up, that's good, period. That's the very definition of good, right? Similarly, if the emperor, these pilots were so conditioned that if the emperor told them to crash their plane into an American battleship, that was good. That was not, that was the very definition of what was valuable, was what the emperor willed. So even though one is a deity in the classical sense and one is kind of a person deified, the pattern of thought is essentially the same.
And I would also add, each one, including the new atheist, has a conception of what the good is, right?
Right.
And they're going to orient their actions according to that. of course there's going to be some relationship between religious belief or just beliefs in the good itself. In that way, I don't know how that bears on the question, but...
Yeah.
One thing that struck me during your talk earlier was that you mentioned that religion stifles intellectual curiosity.
Yes.
Now, I'm not too familiar with Teilhard, but Father Clancy is a lot more. And after all, Teilhard was, I'm sure, are you familiar, Aaron, with a little briefly with Teilhard? He was a Jesuit priest.
Wait a minute, sure, Chardin?
Yes.
Okay.
He was a Jesuit priest as well as a scientist mm-hmm. who was trying to reconcile Darwin's evolutionary theory with Christianity. And
there's actually supposed to be a really good book out just recently about him and the Peking Man.
Oh, the Jesuit Institute.
Yeah, it's supposed to be really good. Yeah.
And, I think that's an example kind of the epitome of intellectual curiosity where someone, a devout Jesuit priest is wrestling with his faith but is also a man of science and he's trying to reconcile the two. I don't think that anyone can say that that is anything but intellectual curiosity.
I do actually. A few thoughts. First of all, the exception doesn't disprove the rule in this case, in that largely priests, especially Jesuit priests, are intellectuals and educated individuals. And so they've precisely self-selected for intellectual curiosity among other traits. Secondly, religion suppresses intellectual curiosity in the general case, not necessarily in every specific case. You can talk about any number of examples of profoundly religious people who have had deep intellectual curiosity about the world around them. I would say that, for example, there are religious beliefs that new atheists see as kind of very typical of the religious worldview, which do, in the majority of adherents, suppress intellectual curiosity. A great example might be biblical literalism. If you believe that the Bible is inerrant and absolutely true, then to look at the world and say, well, maybe we don't know everything. I wonder how the world, came about. Well, you go to the Bible, Genesis tells you, I wonder, why it is that people developed in, a variety of races. You look at the Bible, there's all your answers are right in the Bible, and that suppresses your desire to go out and look for evidence in the world for questions you have, or to question too deeply the beliefs you have. So, well, it's certainly not the case that every religious person will be intellectually uncurious. I think there's a strong case to be made by the new atheists for a lot of religious facets of the religious worldview actively suppressing one's desire to challenge your beliefs, go out and learn more about the world.
It just seems to me like that comment and a lot of your talk is mostly directed at radical Islam and those the pockets of fundamentalist Christianity, which out of the world believers in religion, and particularly the Judeo-Christian tradition, it seems like, you know, the radicalism is really in the minority, and a lot of moderate religious people also criticize vehemently the radical fundamentalism of their religions as well, just as much as the atheists would.
Well, the thing is again, new atheists often will make the case that you only have the fundamentalist aspects because you have the moderate aspects. Fundamentalist Islam, radical Islam, can only exist because there's a huge moderate social support base for it. The several million radical Islamists in the world would not have the support required to continue as a social subgroup without the billion moderate, you know, Muslims in the world. Similarly, just because to say that a lot of these arguments only attack the fundamentalist or the radicalist wing of religion, I think misses kind of some of the subtleties of the arguments, and also again, misses what new atheism thinks is pernicious about religion. Modern religion still has the problems that it, again, religion taken in the new atheist sense, encourages people that faith is that belief without reason is valid, leads new atheist claim to intellectual incuriosity, leads to cliquishness, oppression, and outgroup beliefs. Even if people aren't, you know, committing suicide attacks or murdering apostates, there's still all the fundamental problems with it. And above and beyond all that, there's still not one shred of evidence that any of their holy books have any bearing on reality. So, yes, a lot of the most pressing and poignant criticisms are most easily attached to radical religious groups, but I think the brunt of the attack is still as equally effective on moderate religion.
If I could interject something really quickly here, too. In my response, I didn't want it to sound like I was employing the first mover argument here as a rebuttal against new atheism. My use of the first mover argument was to at least show that it seems like new atheists are in fact not engaging the Christian or the theist arguments. If there are subtleties in new atheism that we're missing, that's fine, but I see short shrift as far as how they're engaging the theists as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my point in bringing up Dawkins' point. He's making a mistake that proponents of this kind of argument wouldn't make a mistake at, or they wouldn't have that as a requirement for the position at all. And it's widely available. So I'm curious what someone like Father Clancy might think in the disinitiation. Just wanted to call on you. You look like you were nodding off. But there's a kind of disingenuousness with the way they represent arguments. And I want to be fair because I haven't read a lot, but for example, Dawkins talks about the ontological argument,
right,
and gives the example of the schoolyard rebuttal of it.
Right.
I can prove God exists. No, you can't. Na 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 na. That's clearly not what the ontological proof is doing.
Would it help, Brad, to just say, I wonder if what would be an analog here would be that if, say, Christian critics of evolution attacked fourth grade biology teachers' presentations, of course Dawkins would protest.
Right.
That's not fair. You want to talk to me, I'm the expert. But Dawkins is playing exactly the same game by picking the most unintellectual representatives of the religious worldview and saying, well, here you go. If they say these stupid things, then religion as a whole is discredited.
Well, and I similarly think that it's a large part of the problem is definitional, or more to the point, goes to the fundament of the two worldviews. The The full form of the first mover argument goes to formal and final causes, right? And not just the actual cause of something in the physical sense, but the explanation for it. Well, final cause, when you get into the hard scientific realm that a lot of new atheists are coming from, is at least fuzzy, if not meaningless. Like, that's kind of the spectrum you work on with final cause when you get into their worldview. So it really comes down to what is admissible as evidence, you know? What definitions are we working with? And those are problems, I think, so fundamental in some instances that the two people can look at the same explanation of the first mover argument, draw completely different things from it, and can both think, and one can think that it's a very credible argument, and the other can think that it's entirely baseless. I think it really comes down to the fundamental definitions that you're dealing with. So.
My question is, according to your explanation of the new atheist movement, what they're doing is, and they're taking the idea and reducing the idea of the Christian ideas to immediacy, right? That's it. It's like they're just proving Christianity to a good point. Well, at the same time, I mean, what we know about science. I mean, because something has to fill that gap for religion, right? You can't just believe in nothing. You've got to believe in science or something, or religion, right? And so what we know about science is just so minute, so little. I mean, there's people out there that would say that most everything you know is wrong. I mean, it's good debate, especially like if you look at like modern age physics, things like that. So is there anything to separate religion out from that kind of paradox?
That's a good question. Again, new atheists, I think, would take a little umbrage at the notion that you need something to replace religion. They would say that religion is most often does explanatory work, where an admission of ignorance is more appropriate. Why does the universe exist? Well, rather than say God did it, why not say we don't know? And so. A lot of them argue that religion fills a lot of roles, none of which it's the sole provider for. There's a lot of, I think, compelling new atheist arguments that religion is not only not the sole source for morality, but not even the source for morality for most religious people. Richard Dawkins talks about, for example, if the Bible is really the source of Christian morals, why don't we stone people who wear poly-cotton blend shirts? Leviticus speaks out pretty strongly against, you know, cloths of multiple fabrics or sowing two crops in one field. So there's a lot of roles for religion, none of which is it irreplaceable according to the new atheists. So you don't really, I mean, you don't have to believe in something necessarily in every case. Again, there's a lot of questions for which we don't have answers scientifically, for which the new atheists would say, we don't have answers, fine, let's admit we don't have answers. Let's not claim that the answer is some, 2,000-year-old Bronze Age, war god who laid down, who these tribesmen wrote myths about and passed them on to their children. And again, that really is the new atheist kind of caricature of Christianity. That these are myths that, probably made loads of sense millennia ago in the desert, but now are showing their age a little. So, does that answer your question?
Roughly.
Okay.
I think a lot of people have questions.
So. Okay.
Mr. Barbecue right here.
In your presentation you said that a lot of what new atheism is reactionary.
Yes.
And do you think it's maybe just possible that just like fundamentalism is reactionary and it can be reactionary in some sense that this new atheism is just a reaction to fundamentalism and in the future, like, do you think it'll be possible that one will stop being angry and chill out and become, I don't know, more rational, I use the word. But like, are these just different reactions of extremes, or is it for like in the future is new atheism gonna take on a new kind of sense?
I would argue that they're rational to a fault, as long as by rational what you mean is very strictly scientifically logically rational. If you use their definition of rational, they're very rational. I would say that new atheism is definitely here to stay for the foreseeable future. Essentially because the task that it set itself is so huge. New atheism is anti-religious to the point where, I mean, they really are taking on in a very fundamental way institutions which have been around for the whole of human history, or very nearly so. Even if new atheism is very, very successful, that's a huge task to tackle. So even by their own optimistic standards, it's an uphill battle. It's going to be a long one. I don't think that they're going to be chilling out anytime in the near future, largely because I see no sign that their opposition is. Again, in America, largely their opposition is fundamentalist evangelical Christianity for the most part. Again, that wing of American culture shows no signs of chilling out either. So, I mean, if you're buying tickets, you're in for a good fight, I think. Okay. So, yeah.
John.
Dr. DeMaria wanted everyone to know that the gentleman had saw God, so if there's any questions.
Because what was that thing that Hume said about evidence for miracles? Anyone who gives evidence is probably right. So, something like that. I don't know. I'm probably misquoting.
Yeah, so, but I wanted to do like the converse of the question of the body count. my question, so if they're isolating these terrorist actions by extremist fundamentalists, which ostensibly have this religious motivation, what about, we might say, an equally minority other side that might be doing good things or historically beneficial things that wouldn't have existed without religious motivations? For instance, the way in which religion helps groups...
Catholic charities, for example.
Well, yeah. And even like political kinds where you wouldn't have just good guys helping each other, but, you know, like certain kinds of anti-colonial movements or something might be beneficial, like labor, organized labor around religious groups in, say, South America or something like that, where it seems like it's a question of secular aims that are destructive, right? I don't know, United Banana Corp or whatever.
Right.
And then people using religion as a motivation for being good. And I think your example of the monitor's children is a good one, because I think it works the same kind of way. So monitor's children are growing up, right? And they might not become monitor's economists, and they might not be stifled in that sense, the same way that some religious believer might become a theologian, but they're going to become monetarist businessmen, and they're not going to have the kind of self-reflexivity to find the most rational form of economy and some future organization of society, and you're stifling our economic growth by becoming a monetarist businessman.
Right.
We would be if we were just going to be rank-and-file believers. So it's that in that same kind of analogy, you have motivations to move to the limits of the body of knowledge available, which may include religious claims.
Right.
Theologize.
I think the only claim that, the only comment the new atheist would say is, yes, and again, monetarists don't kill monetarist apostates. If I was born monetarist and become a Keynesian later in life, no one's going to chop off my head for it. Actually, I know some economy students who might. But they're the exception rather than the rule. But I think you're right in that there is a bit of a blind spot in new atheism, going back to kind of the first point you made. They're very selective often about motivation, religious motivation. Personally, I think that they'd be better off largely focusing on ideological claims made by religion and basic fundamental religious beliefs. As soon as religious motivations for terrorism, for example, get dragged in, it raises the question of, for example, the Tamil Tigers. Largely secularist, still engage in suicide attacks. And yes, new atheists can say, well, culturally, the Tamil people have religious history, but largely, if you look at the demographics of Tamil terrorists, largely they're not religious people.
And they're the largest terrorist organization in the world, right?
Exactly. So, and this is the kind of thing where the new atheists largely just don't mention. Whether by willful admission or they think it's beside the point in some sense, I'm not really sure. Probably varies on case-by-case basis. But to say that there's some pretty strong claims you have to support when you say that religion causes terrorism. You can say that in a certain attack, in a certain instance, religion was a factor, but to say that religion as such causes terrorism, I think is a very steep claim. Similarly, usually when they talk about religion encouraging charity, they're very quick to point out any number of secular charities, humanitarianism, things like that.
Well, that's why I try to avoid charity internally and things of that nature. Where it seems that religion is part of the reason for being, kind of coheres a group or something like that.
Right. So, yeah, and so I think definitely the specific area of religious motivation for action is a bit of a weak spot in the New Atheist in the New Atheist canon, I guess you could say. The person who speaks most to it is, I think, Daniel Dennett, and he's pretty even-handed about it, making very kind of general claims.
Maybe one more question.
Yeah, Dr. DiMaria.
Yeah, Aaron. I'm wondering to what extent you can address this question.
Sure. I'm sure I can, totally.
I have every what do you think about the epistemology that seems to underlie this whole thing? I mean, it seems to be a fundamentally positivist framework about truth and knowledge, which, you know, philosophically is not the fundamental thing. So to the extent that the New Atheism rests upon it,
I would assert that the implicit epistemology of New Atheism is the scientific method. Basically, it applies the scientific worldview not just to classical questions of empirical knowledge, but rather to any claim of fact you make about the world. Right.
So, that is being set. And so why should we accept?
And again, New Atheism will say, well, if it's not part of the world, how do we even talk about it? How can we even say anything coherent, much less true, about religion?
But then again, you're just presupposing about what is true, right? Mm. I mean, you're presupposing that truth is delimited within a very definite framework,
that
maybe what is empirically verifiable.
Right.
And I don't see why anybody ought to embrace that.
Would another way to ask the question be, on Dawkins' epistemology, doing mathematics doesn't even make any sense, because we're not dealing with empirical realities when we do math.
Again, I guess math would be a descriptive project. Math is useful only that it helps us understand facts about the world. And he would say that theology doesn't even help us do that. There's no theological argument that you can make that will help us better understand physics or chemistry or biology. It will no better help us. No intellectual endeavor in theology will help us better make sense of the world in which we live.
I'm still suggesting this, though, that there are aspects of epistemology itself which have to be presupposed if you're going to talk about truth.
Yeah.
But there are aspects about epistemology itself which are not verifiable.
Well.
So you've got to presuppose some kinds of truths that are not reducible to what is empirically verifiable or scientifically verifiable.
And again, I think they would simply say that we can only take as axiomatic brute evidence and kind of laws of non-contradiction. Other than those, I think they would say that it takes much more of an epistemological leap to believe in a deity than it does to just, you know, believe in the brute reality around us.
Well, I'll just one last thing, and then I'll swear.
Okay.
I
Yeah. And I think, well, I think largely, I mean, you really hit on when you said that, you know, there's kind of a normative dimension to all this. New atheists are saying not only that the only things we can know are scientific, you know, that the only facts that matter are scientific facts, but that people should adopt a scientific epistemological framework. That the way in which you address the world around you should be scientific to the greatest extent possible. And they really do make a proscriptive claim about that. That should be the way you address the world, because it's the only way you can make predictions about what's going to happen. It's the only way you can really make any kind of strong claims about the world in which you experience and in which you live.
With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. We can continue the conversation if you'd like. Let's thank our speakers once again.